Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I am your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. Bob is off on assignment. He's wrapping that assignment up soon, so Bob will probably be back soon, probably for episodes we're recording next week. And I also just want to do a quick shout out. We have been named in the top 100 progressive politics podcasts by Million Podcasts. We've also been named in their most revolutionary podcast list. We're actually number 51 on that list. And so I just wanted to do a quick shout out to that. So all the more reason to listen to the Green and Red podcast. But also, like, at the great content in which we produce, which today's episode is going to be another example of that. And joining me to talk about today's topic, which is going to be the Canadian elections, is Amelia Béliveau. Amelia has worked on climate and environmental justice issues for over a decade. She's been a community organizer, an academic researcher, a social policy analyst, campaigner with different environmental nonprofits. She has a master's in environmental studies that is focused on, or her research is focused on climate justice movement praxis. Welcome to the Green and Red podcast.
Thank you.
And this week we had an election in Canada, which actually got a lot of news around the world and here in the US. The Liberal Party, which had been massively trailing in the polls, pulled off what seems to be a narrow victory in just about 2 months, largely. At least the way the U.S. media is framing this is largely because Trump had repeatedly, including on Election Day, threatened to make Canada the 51st state. Also, there are other factors involved there. Justin Trudeau had resigned, handing the leadership over to Mark Carney. So we're going to talk a little bit about that election. There's a couple of other things that sort of played out during that, like the other left parties took some hits as a result of this Liberal victory. Other interesting part is that the conservative leader, who seems to have been the one that blew the election, Pierre Poilievre.
Yeah.
He also lost his seat. And we're going to be talking about all of that. So maybe we could start with, can you just tell us what happened on Monday? Just a general overview, some broad strokes would be a good way to start.
Yes. The Canadian election on Monday had results that didn't really get finalized till quite late in the game. But the outcome is that the Liberal government was able to hold on to enough seats that it stays in power. So Mark Carney will continue to be the prime minister, but it was a pretty narrow margin. They were hoping to get a majority. Polling even last week said that was a potential outcome, and they didn't quite get that. They're a few seats shy of a majority government, which means that they'll have to work with other parties in order to maintain power. So a majority government in the past sometimes leads to really excellent progressive outcomes because particularly left-wing parties have been able to push for stronger stances from the Liberals, but also more likely that we will have an election before the four-year term, which they, if they had won a majority, would be assured that they could govern for the next 4 years. And as you mentioned off the top, some of our more left-wing parties took some major hits, a real implosion of the NDP, who lost a number of really key voices.
Including their leader, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it wasn't just Pierre Poilievre who lost his leadership seat, but Jagmeet Singh also lost his and pretty immediately has stepped down. So there'll be a leadership race in the NDP, which is another, I think, really interesting things that we could discuss. And there's a lot of potential in revived NDP in a rebuilding phase. But that means that the members that they do have in government are going to be stretched pretty thin. Even though Poilievre lost his seat, he said he's staying on and is going to run in likely Alberta. They're going to call a by-election so that he can get back into the House of Commons. And then also the Green Party in Canada has a co-leader situation. So one of their leaders, a longtime parliamentarian, Elizabeth May, kept her seat, but their other co-leader, Jonathan Pineau, wasn't able to win his seat. So he has also stepped down. So we've had three leaders of political parties not actually be able to be elected in their own ridings and, yeah, are taking different paths.
And the Greens got reduced down to just one seat, correct?
Yeah. They were never a major party. They've never had enough seats to have major party status. but they did lose Mike Morris, who was a quite a strong MP as well. So they're back down to just one.
And the NDP went something from like 20 or 25 seats to five, correct?
They got seven, yes.
Seven,
But I
seven.
think they had 20, they had 25-ish
Yeah.
before. So they've had the largest loss, and they lost a lot of people who were really strong voices on a lot of issues, but including on climate.
And just to keep on that topic for a minute, that means they lose a lot of sort of benefits and status as a result of losing all those seats, correct?
Yeah, so the NDP lost official party status, which means they still they're the MPs are still there in the seat of government participating. But what that means, for example, is that now they're not obligated to be included on cross-parliamentary committees, or there's these different sort of like process-based things, and I think some financial implications as well for their parties. So it definitely is a hit and will impact how effective they're able to be.
And also, this is a result of the Liberals running. The Liberals were something like 20 points behind, like at the time of Trump's inauguration, just to take it back to that. And this is a result of just more people voting for the Liberals so that the Conservatives didn't have some sort of win. Is that correct? I know it's mostly
Mostly,
speculative, but.
yeah. So, yeah, you're totally right. The story for the longest time in the lead up to this election was that Pierre Poilievre had been really effective at pushing this axe the tax messaging. He's got a lot of catchy slogans, and the right in Canada has been doing a lot of base building. And so they were about 20 points ahead for the most of the past year. And then the Liberal Party, also just like the leader, the former leader, Justin Trudeau, widely unpopular at the end of two terms in leadership. And after Trudeau stepped down, which happened, I guess, in February, there was a clear desire across Canada for change. And so the Liberal Party made the choice, and Trudeau made the choice to step down. So with the election of a new leader, there's one sort of facet of change that people were more willing to except the Liberal Party. But then, yeah, the major thing being Trump and his stepping into office, the threats against Canadian sovereignty, and the tariffs, and the way that all of that basically the Liberals were able to really represent themselves as the party to push back against Trump, and Carney himself as this player with a more international reputation, new to electoral politics, but has this sort of long history of working in the global banking space, seen as being more capable at handling international diplomacy and challenging Trump. And the other thing that the Liberals did right off the bat, which is unfortunate for climate policy, but was like strategic and in the end successful for them, is that they like Carney got in and then decided to axe the carbon tax. So the main issue that Poilievre had been talking about for truly years as the reason why you needed to vote him in instead of the Liberals basically became a non-issue, and they had really sunk all of their they'd sunk so much energy into making that what this election was going to be about. And then the Liberal government did it themselves, took all the air out of the room around that conversation. And so the Conservative Party had a really hard time changing their messaging and finding a new foothold with the public.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, there was the sort of trucker convoy. I think that was in 2022. We actually did a show on it. And so an element of that was around climate and how all of these truckers were being going to be affected by Trudeau's climate policies, which is why they wanted to go occupy Ottawa. Is that correct? Am I remembering that?
The carbon tax part of is was part of it, but I would say more than specific climate action from the Trudeau government was a general just, yeah, like real despising of Trudeau and what he represents as a person. And it wasn't just climate. It had all these other facets
I remember
around
there was a
it.
COVID element, I think, to it as
Yeah,
well.
exactly. It was like the trucker convoy started before the COVID pandemic, but then in the aftermath of it really converged with the anti-vax movement and with other sort of right-wing groups talking about government overreach and conspiracy theories and things like that. So it had seeds from some of the climate ambition of the former government, but it became a sort of beast of its own.
We talked about Mark Carney a little bit. He called for an election 9 days after Trudeau stepped down and he became the leader. Is there a little more you can tell us about Mark Carney? He's not your traditional kind of politician. He's actually was a central banker of both the Canadian and British English central banks. And he has a bit of a background in global finance, global economy.
Yeah. So he, as you mentioned, has this background as a central banker and was really part of the like international leadership around some of the climate finance commitments, like the, I forget what it's called exactly, but the agreements that banks made in Glasgow.
Like net zero.
Yeah, net zero commitments there. He wrote a book many years ago that is very much like about climate change and the role of finance and climate change. So he's one of these people who's got this reputation for understanding climate issues. Certainly his approach to solutions is grounded in capitalist finance. We expect that he has like a strong grasp on the threat to security, the threat to financial systems. Even there's an expectation that we're not going to have to teach him about how serious this issue is. But the approach that he's taken in the past, for example, with banks in that global pact, was a voluntary one. It's about mobilizing private finance to meet public finance. It's about voluntary commitments. It's not necessarily about regulating or managing a decline in fossil fuels. And the Liberal Party before Carney had this very all of the above approach. This is part of why Trudeau managed to piss everybody off, is because he said, yes, we can do it all, and bought a pipeline, making all of the climate people mad, but then still implemented climate policy, which made all of the anti-climate people mad. So it's yet to be seen whether Carney will differentiate himself from that path that has the Liberals have long played as a very like proudly centrist party, where they are not willing to like stake a major claim on something that is a little bit more radical.
How much would you say climate politics overall factored in on this election?
This election climate was very quiet. It still remained one of the sort of top five issues that people reported caring about in polling. But compared to previous years where it was in the number one or number two slot, it is a real downgrade. And it was not a major issue that parties themselves were trying to promote. So it was, as somebody who works in climate, it's disappointing on the one hand to see it take a back seat, but I can see how the Liberals decided to play that in terms of their own strategy. I also think, even though people weren't talking about climate, we have seen this reemergence of a pipeline conversation because issues of affordability, national unity, the threat of Trump are the things that were, and the housing crisis, I should say, as well, like the things that were really occupying people's minds during the election. What that has led to is this kind of push from the fossil fuel industry to revive the pipeline conversation as a way to keep itself relevant and say, oh, we'll address these concerns through becoming a fossil fuel superpower. So there are certainly implications for the climate crisis of everything that was discussed in the election and as issues as part of the election, but the topic of like climate action and climate solutions was not a major talking point. And in fact, yeah, as I said, we're having to figure out how to fight these pipelines that we all celebrated being dead, and now they're coming back as zombies that we have to.
And which ones are going to be making a comeback?
So for example, there's talk about East-West pipeline, like Energy East, that project. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a proponent. It's a bad idea for 100 reasons that I could go on about. But what we're seeing is people still care about climate change, but the narrative of needing basically to find ways for Canada to diversify its economy or stop being so reliant on the US and its trade relations. And this is like the fossil fuel industry's really done a good job, or its fossil fuel industry supporters have done a good job of putting this out there as the proposal for how do we build a stronger Canada. So it's a new fight, but an old one all the same.
Because you work within the climate movement, how would you say that the climate movement, the climate community in Canada, how supportive were they of Carney? How supportive, or were they more supportive of the Greens or the NDP? Where did that community fall in to this last election?
I think because Polyev posed such a real threat for so long, there was a great sense of like relief and excitement when it became clear that it wasn't a sure thing that Polyev would get in. The climate movement itself like has dispersed support across progressive parties and people. Some people see the pragmatism of supporting a local liberal candidate who's a climate progressive. And so it's like pretty mixed. I'd say the challenge in Canada is you vote in your local election for your local candidate. But most of the coverage, the media, the conversation is framed in this national container where it's like, who do you want to be the prime minister? And so one of the things that we saw, as we alluded to before, is this strategic voting to keep Polyev out across progressive movements. And with certain parts of the public who are not as engaged in the political discussion, the sort of narrative is, okay, the liberals are who will keep Carney out, or sorry, who will keep Polyev out. And then in the context of a local riding, it's not always the case that the liberals are going to be the ones to defeat the conservatives. And so we saw really disappointing results in certain areas where there was a major split among left and the Liberal Center Party, and we lost really wonderful progressive candidates because, or even had conservative candidates win because of, yeah, the sort of the downside of strategic voting.
Right. It's in the US in 2020, we saw progressives get behind Biden because they wanted to get rid of Trump. But in 2024, that didn't really happen as much. The wedge here in 2024, I would say, was Gaza, genocide in Gaza. And how much of a factor do you think that played in it? And I realize that Canada doesn't give the kind of support that US does to Israel, but still.
Yeah, but traditionally has still been supportive
right.
of Israel. I think like the pro-Palestinian in organizing that has been happening in Canada in the past year has been pretty incredible. The strength of that, the gains that they have made are significant for sure. So you definitely saw in the lead up to the election, like the NDP become way more vocal. We've got some MPs, Heather McPherson in particular, like getting motions passed in the House to call for a ceasefire, even if it was a watered down version, because the Liberal Party still has a lot of like pro-Israel support. And McPherson also led the motion around getting an international arms, like blocking arms sales to Israel.
Like an embargo,
we don't have a two-way embargo, but there was movement on that. So I think like really what you saw has been a slow progress pushing the Canadian government to be more accountable. But when it comes to how it played out in the election, I don't see a clear pattern, because you lost some MPs who were really vocally supportive of Gaza and Palestine. And then also, yeah, there's just not a clear pattern that emerged. I would love to talk to somebody who was involved with the election organizing for the Palestine movement folks and see what their impression is. But my impression is that I haven't been able to discern necessarily a pattern around how that played out as any sort of wedge issue.
The other actually thing I meant to ask about this earlier, but I think it's important as we're talking about these like different topics and impacts on the campaign, is the tariffs and the trade war. And that's been a huge topic here in the U.S. and between U.S. and China, between the U.S. and Canada, between the U.S. and Mexico. And I'm wondering, I'm assuming that Polyev is a little bit of a collateral damage in Trump's trade war with Canada. And how much, I think a large portion of the Canadian population lives along the border within 50 or 60 miles of the U.S., correct? And so, like, how much did the trade war and the tariffs really impact? And Trump also talks a lot about increasing border security, not just along our southern border, but our northern border as well. And makes all kinds of wild accusations about fentanyl coming in from Canada and things like that. But I'm wondering how much of these trade war tariff stuff really, where did that leave your sort of everyday Canadian? Not that I know you can't speak for everybody, but I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Yeah, I think it was hugely impactful. Basically, like, Canadians were already feeling like a cost of living crisis and affordability crisis. And so, both the threat and direct impact that tariffs will have on groceries and everyday prices is real and certainly galvanized people. But there's an element to it too around this idea and perception of the relationship between Canada and the US that I think your average Canadian really believes in around like this sense of allyship and being a good neighbor and all of that type of thing. And so there's both the direct impact of tariff policies on prices and on job loss, particularly like the aluminum industry in Quebec and the auto industry in Ontario. But then there's also, I think, been this really funny thing where I think your average like Joe Canadian also feels this sense of betrayal. And that sort of prompted the elbows up movement and a revival of this idea of a Canadian unity and a Canadian identity that has a lot of really interesting political implications that have the potential to have some positive gains made through them if we can articulate and fight for things that differentiate Canada from the United States, like doubling down on strengthening our healthcare system and these things like that, but also pose some real risks around like a Canadian nationalism that gets sucked into some of the like corrosive identity politics stuff that could potentially lead to anti-immigration sentiment or that is like doubles down on any sort of austerity. It's an interesting time where there's a sense of, I think, momentum and optimism that people are feeling around what like a unified and stronger version of Canada could be. But it comes with these real risks as well, as different people fight over what that identity actually is and means, because sometimes like some of the actions so far are these like shallow identity markers. You've got people saying we're going to buy Canadian as the way we're standing up for ourselves against the Trump tariffs, but that's still a very like consumer and neoliberal based approach to culture, identity, stateship.
Well, when you get down to the kind of cultural politics in the US, buying American, I put that in finger quotes, is actually some of the root of what has given Trump his power and influence too. It's definitely a slippery slope. I would actually say, how prevalent is like nativism, nativist feeling, nativist groups in Canada? I also say this, is that Trump poll on the, he's currently plummeting in polls and where he what his policies are on polls, but the one he does the best in still currently, even though it's dropping as well, is on immigration, which is like this white nationalist sort of position on that. I'm curious where where are Canadians on that? Or do they have similar feelings?
I think Trump's influence has been felt in Canada. I think it's been concerning to see, excuse me, a rise in anti-immigration sentiment. I don't think it's the same as the US per se.
Let's hope not.
But I do think, particularly in the way that the housing crisis has become really severe here, I think that is immigration becomes a scapegoat for the housing crisis. And so if we can do more to better manage the housing crisis, then it's a bit of a release valve for some of the way that anti-immigration narrative gets mobilized and the way the right capitalizes on various crises to further sow and seed division around immigration.
And the housing crisis being around the cost of housing.
Cost of housing and access. Like the places in Canada that are growing and cities that haven't been building affordable housing. So there's both like a supply issue where people are, and also the costs have skyrocketed just like astronomically since the pandemic, even in places where like you would have 5 years ago been still assured a reasonable rent are now prices that are outpacing certain cities. And renter protections that were in place during the pandemic have now stopped, like they've ended. And so people are in a lot of precarity.
Because I think this is what I'm going to ask about next is root cause of some of that precarity, economic precarity, that sort of thing, is like neoliberalism and the politics around neoliberalism. We've definitely been seeing an upsurge of within both political parties that has a sort of anti-neoliberal approach. The establishment Democrats continue to own that, as well as like many establishment Republicans. But I'm wondering, was Polyev, does he have more of an anti-neoliberal like perspective here? Is he more in the sort of like wanting to be more of a nationalist sort of ideology ingrained in Canada and within the Conservative Party?
I think he mobilizes those narratives and like where he's been able to get success publicly. He's certainly not afraid of using some of that language, but in terms of policies, like that wasn't, he doesn't have a vision or like an approach to governing that is not neoliberal. Like he's, I'd say Trump has his big
Trump has a narrative around it too, but on some exceptions.
Yeah, I think Polyev is a career politician. He's never had a job, like a real full-time job, that is not being an MP. And his interest in governing is like certainly to govern to the right of all the other parties, small government, economic austerity, but he's been really good at tapping into the broader public concerns around affordability, housing, et cetera, and not really having to offer solutions. Like he's in there, they didn't come out with a platform till super late in the game, and all of his policy things, it's all just, it's cutting taxes. There's not a lot of substance to actualizing like programs to meet the concerns of people. And yeah, I think there's just a shallowness there and a lack of imagination. Like, I don't think Polyev is deeply conservative and in ways that would be extremely damaging to both the material reality and the social fabric of Canada. But also he's not like a visionary. Like, he doesn't have, or at least he hasn't articulated a vision for conservatism in Canada that is that different than Harper. Harper was his mentor for a while. We've also seen the version of that would play out were he to be back in.
Whereas in contrast, it's like very clear that Carney is the sort of globalist, right? That he was a central banker, including over the Central Bank of England. I'm sure he'll be actually a lightning rod for at least people on the right in America about how somehow these Canadian globalists are ruining our country. That's a big thing they're into. Those sorts of narratives.
Yeah, fun things to look forward to.
Yeah, fun, more and more. And they already do that with Sheinbaum in Mexico as well. My last question, we're seeing similar trends happen in other parts of the world. The Australian elections this weekend, and we have also seen with the Labour Party, which is their version of the Liberals, or the Democrats actually were like neck and neck or somewhat trailing, have pulled ahead as a result of the Liberals in Australia or the Conservatives. It's all very confusing. But the Liberal Party in Australia is like the sort of right-wing party, and they haven't actually been able to make a good argument that how they're not like Trump. And many people around the world find Trump very distasteful. And I'm wondering, that seems to be the sort of case with Polyev, is he wasn't actually able to come up with a narrative that sort of countered that he was not somehow aligned with the Americans and Trump and the Republicans. And I'm just wondering what your thought, and we're also seeing similar stuff happen in the UK too, right? So I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you said about Polyev there is totally true. There were like campaigns that sort of identified the ways in which he was, but yeah, I mean, if Canada is like a bellwether for this shift in international politics, that would be really interesting. We'll see too as it plays out, because Carney does come from this very like international space and has talked about strengthening relationships with Europe and other players as a way to diversify our economy and not be so reliant on the US trade relationships. I think the success of that approach will also either strengthen the conviction of others to move away from capitulating to Trump versus finding another path. So I'm certainly interested to see the outcome of that. Yeah, every place is different, but It would be a nice change of pace after the series of right-wing takeovers, or like gains, at least in different
Right.
parts of the world.
Yeah, particularly within the supposed left, or excuse me, the supposed West, like the sort of
Yeah.
where the liberal democracies are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm going to wrap it at that. Folks, we've been talking about the Canadian elections with Amelia Beliveau, who is a campaigner and organizer and researcher in with different environmental and within the climate movement in Canada. But talking about the politics, also a policy analyst on Politics of Canada, as we just saw. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to this on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. It helps us with the algorithms. And then if you really like us, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit the support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And once again, check out Million Podcasts, where we've made at least like three of their lists of like top podcasts. And we hope to talk to everybody again really soon. Amelia, thanks for joining us today. Everybody else, go out and misbehave and make lots of trouble. And we'll talk to you again soon.